Welcome to the Advances in Healthcare Month, sponsored by Battelle. Now here's your host, Tom Tennant.
Some healthcare and disease-related research is so out there, it takes nerve to fund it, hoping it'll produce some payoff. For more than a decade, the National Institutes of Health has devoted a regular portion of its research dollars to what it calls high-risk, high-rewards projects that might seem a little out of the mainstream. But NIH has had some payoffs. Dr. Elizabeth Wilder is director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. She explains what the high-risk, high-rewards program is all about.
The high-risk, high-reward program began in 2004 as part of a new endeavor at the NIH called the NIH Roadmap. So then Director Elias Zerhouni was interested in establishing a corporate strategy for scientific planning at the NIH. This involved the directors of all of the institutes and centers at the NIH, and collectively they established several scientific programs with defined goals, all of which were considered to be high risk, high reward. And this, they provided 1% of the budget of NIH to pay for these programs. One component,
which is not a small amount of money, really.
It's not a small amount of money, but it's a small percentage. So part of this endeavor called the Roadmap was called specifically High Risk, High Reward. It did not have defined goals. It was really up to the individual investigators to specify high risk, high reward objectives.
So these would be what they would nowadays call moonshot type of things. That might be the worst expression ever applied to this type of thing, but that's kind of what you had in mind.
Right. So that was really the plan for the whole roadmap endeavor. In some cases, in most of the cases, the NIH specified those high-risk objectives. But in this portion of it that was dedicated for investigator-initiated projects, the individual investigators specified those objectives. So the first initiative within this high-risk, high-reward program was called the Pioneer Program. So that one began in 2004. And over time, we've established four separate initiatives within this high-risk, high-reward component, and that's the history.
Have there been, since 2004, can you point to an example of something that looked like a really long shot that you funded with some of that 1% and it paid off?
Sure. I think probably one of my favorite programs has been the Human Microbiome Project. So this began in 2007, and the goal for this component of the roadmap, which is now referred to as the NIH Common Fund because it's a common fund within the NIH to support these high-risk endeavors, the Human Microbiome Project sought to understand all of the microbes that live in and on human beings, and to establish how diverse that ecosystem of microbes are and what they do for human biology. And it was a large concerted effort to understand all of those microbes, and it has really transformed the way that we think about human health. Microbes provide a lot of information to our bodies, to our immune system, probably to our brains. We're just really still beginning to understand that connection between the gut and the brain. And it has been really exciting.
And you mentioned microbes in or on the human body?
Sure. On the skin. Your microbes on your skin provide information to the rest of your body.
So that research could either drive you to take a shower every hour or stay out of the shower for the rest of your life.
Well, that's right. I mean, for me personally, it has made me much more accepting of you know, microbes on us. Right.
All right. So it mentions in the program description about this whole effort, it mentions potential for high impact ideas, but some that might be too novel right now to stand up to peer review process that would be for something less novel. What's an example of something so novel that it can't stand up to peer review, but yet, on the other hand, somebody might say, let's put some money behind it?
Right. Well,
'cause that sounds like a fine line.
Yeah, it is. So one of the hallmarks of the programs that we support is risk. We accept a lot of risk in our programs. But you're right, it is sort of a fine line. We want them to be feasible.
Because otherwise it becomes mad scientist kind of thing,
correct,
which could be cockamamie.
Right.
But somebody has the hunch that, there might be something here.
So I think one example is we are supporting a program now to try to understand the function of molecules that circulate in our bloodstream, in our cerebrospinal fluid, that are RNA molecules that for decades, scientists really thought only lived inside a cell. But we now know they float around, and we know that they can be taken up by other cells and they have a function. But we don't really understand what those functions are. So this is a pretty new idea, the idea that RNAs circulate and provide functions remotely. And to understand what those RNA molecules are doing is not incredibly widely received by peer review groups. So we are putting significant resources into understanding what these molecules do. The idea is that this could provide an entirely new paradigm for intercellular signaling, how the body works. And so that's really kind of where we come in. It's a high-risk objective that we're providing some support for.
We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Wilder, director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. And so if something doesn't fare well in traditional peer review, who makes that decision that, let's take a look and see what this RNA is doing floating around there?
Well, so we ask the peer reviewers to think out of the box. We say that there's some evidence that these molecules are doing important things. We're trying to understand what they're doing. And so we ask the peer reviewers to get into the spirit of that, to not be so dedicated towards vast amounts of preliminary data showing function. And so the peer reviewers like that. They like to have, I think, the freedom to say, yes, if this works, this would be amazing. And this would really be important if we could understand it. So for the reviews that go into our programs, the scientific community gets on board and embraces that.
When you mentioned the microbes earlier and the RNA floating around in the bloodstream, it almost seems as if maybe the one understanding that's unstated behind this is that nothing happens by accident in the realm of science where NIH is looking.
Well, I don't know about that. I think there are things that happen somewhat randomly. And
in biology?
In biology. But it's sometimes hard to know what's random and what is done by design. And so the only way that you understand that is by looking at many people doing experiments, and that's the nature of research.
Now, NIH is composed of many siloed institutes, so there's a sense here that this is cross-disciplinary in some cases.
Right.
And so how do you work that when does this belong in Institute A or B?
Well, that's a great question. That's our sweet spot at the NIH. So the Common Fund programs are by design supporting science that's relevant to all or many institutes and centers across the NIH. So our office coordinates a process where we work with staff across the NIH to develop these programs, to manage them. And sometimes individual projects that are supported within our broader programs are relevant to one single institute, but collectively, they're very broadly relevant.
Now, is the money available to people only within NIH, or can external scientists and academic institutions, or even perhaps maybe the pharma industry, avail themselves of these? Grants, I take it?
Yeah, most of it goes outside the NIH. So we do support some research within the intramural program at the NIH, but the vast majority of it goes outside.
And do you ever get some oversight, say, by a congressman that may not understand all of this and say, what are you looking at microbes crawling across fingernails for?
I think Congress is, we interact with them. We provide information, but they're supportive. I think generally They like the idea that NIH has a small percentage of its funds that are dedicated towards these high-risk objectives, And so we try to be clear about what we're trying to do, and generally they're supportive of that.
Dr. Elizabeth Wilder is director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. In part two of this interview, Wilder describes how the cross-cutting program fits in an agency made of separate institutes. I'm Tom Temin.
This is the sound of healthcare saving lives. But now healthcare needs help. Patient visits, costs, and paperwork are all spiraling. This is the sound of a team of technologists and engineers at Battelle studying big data, making healthcare healthier, improving patient outcomes. With Battelle, it can be done. Learn more at battelle.org/outcomes.
At the National Institutes of Health, an agency made of separate and distinct silos, a program that might involve several of them presents a challenge. The high-risk, high-rewards program funds promising but early research in health that might involve more than one institute. Dr. Elizabeth Wilder is director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. In part two of my interview, she explains how it all fits together.
So we are housed within the Office of the Director at NIH, and specifically a division within the Office of the Director called the Division of Program Coordination, Planning, and Strategic Initiatives. And this division was created in 2006 by Congress in the Reform Act of 2006. So it's a specific component of the Office of the Director that supports scientific programs that cut across the NIH. So we're one office within that division.
Now, I can't name all of the NIH institutes off the top of my head, but is there an issue ever with overlap where, you know, maybe brain and cranial will say, hey, that's mine, and jaw, neck, and shoulders will say, no, it's really ours. Those aren't great examples, but you know
right.
what I mean.
So there are areas of overlap between institutes and centers, and each institute and center describes its mission to the public, to the scientific community. And when there are projects that are relevant to multiple institutes and centers, they get together, they decide where it goes. Sometimes they co-fund a given project.
And talking about, again, the high-risk, high-reward program that's been in place since 2004, we were talking about basic scientific investigations earlier concerning RNA, for example, and its function outside of a cell. What about the clinical side of NIH? A lot of practical ideas are tested there for, you know, when hospitals fail, people can go to NIH and try the latest. How much of the high-risk, high-reward program goes to clinical endeavors?
I'm not sure what the percentage is. We do fund programs that are more clinical in nature. So the programs that we support are really range the spectrum from very basic to more clinical. The clinical programs that we support are not clinical trials per se. We provide support for the development of tools that are available that are useful in clinical research. As an example, we supported the development of something called the Patient Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System, and it's a computer adaptive tool which enables clinical investigators and clinicians to get a more reproducible read on how patients are doing. And so within the context of clinical research, it helps the investigators know how an individual patient is progressing through a clinical trial, for example. So we don't support the actual trials, but this new tool has really enabled trials to be done in a faster and easier way. We're currently supporting another program called the Healthcare Systems Collaboratory, where we're trying to enable partnerships to form more easily between healthcare provider organizations and academic research institutions. So in that context, we are supporting clinical trials, but they are trials specifically that healthcare providers are interested in. So is treatment A better than treatment B? How can we compare these to accepted treatments to serve the patients better?
Now, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has a program running for a few years now to try to reduce hospital accidents and deaths and preventable types of things that kill thousands of people every year. Does some of that data translate over or come from NIH? Is there any collaboration in the other health components across the government?
We have interactions with other agencies. There's a lot of crosstalk at the staff level. The types of studies that CMS supports are distinct from ours. The types of studies that I just described are, it's really more of a research endeavor to compare the efficacy of two treatments. So they're related, but they're distinct.
And I wanted to ask you about a fourth component in this, the Director's Early Independence Award, which is not as old as the whole program. That was started in 2011. What does that one do?
So the Early Independence Awards are intended to provide a way for scientists who have just finished their training to go straight into an independent research position without going through a separate training period, postdoctoral fellowships. So we're trying to understand how many individuals are prepared to do that immediately after their training period. Most scientists benefit from a postdoctoral training period, but it does extend the time between your doctoral training and when you become an independent scientist. So the Early Independence Awards allow individual investigators to skip that and go straight into independent research. So we feel like this is pretty exciting for those individuals who get these awards, and we're in the process of assessing how well they do. Do they benefit from skipping that postdoc or not?
Because you might be getting people at the height of their brain power. Isn't it often thought that if you haven't discovered the great thing by the time you're 30, forget about it. It'll never happen.
Well, that is the thinking.
That could be
of some.
A myth. I don't know.
But I think the analyses that the NIH Office of Extramural Research has done shows that people really do continue to come up with good ideas for a long time.
Dr. Elizabeth Wilder is director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. I'm Tom Temin.
This is the sound of healthcare saving lives. But now healthcare needs help. Patient visits, costs, and paperwork are all spiraling. This is the sound of a team of technologists and engineers at Battelle studying big data, making healthcare healthier, improving patient outcomes. With Battelle, it can be done. Learn more at battelle.org/outcomes.
We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Wilder, director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. Let's get back to some of those areas that too novel, span too diverse a range of disciplines, too early a stage to do well in traditional peer review process, the real heart of the high risk, high reward program. What other examples can you think of that might have resulted in some area of endeavor, some new knowledge that eventually will help us all?
Well, I'll give you an example of an effort that we supported that really required a lot of coordinated effort amongst staff at the NIH, many investigators working together. That was, I think there was a lot of skepticism when it began that it would actually be feasible. And this program is called Genotype Tissue Expression, or GTEx. And this began, I think, in 2010, if I'm recalling. And the idea was to try to understand how genetic variation from individual to individual results in changes in the activity of genes. And so the driver behind this was the fact that many, many studies across the NIH had correlated changes in your DNA sequence with changes or your susceptibility to many diseases. But when you look at the DNA that is correlates with your susceptibility to disease, it often doesn't lie in a gene. It lies outside in this mystery DNA.
It's kind of like the mystery RNA. There's also
Correct.
Mystery DNA out there.
Right. So the
maybe they should get together and come up with something
well,
new.
Well, I think they probably do, actually. So the idea behind GTEx was to look at the all of these variants, the genetic variants, and try to correlate those changes with changes in gene expression or the activity of the genes. But the problem is that the the genes that are active may be active in your brain, may be active in your heart, and living individuals don't really want to cough up those tissues, right? So we were forced to look at cadaveric donors. So, but we needed many of them to be able to do statistical analysis between the changes in genes and the changes in gene expression. So the problem here was that we would be looking at gene activity in cadaveric donors.
Is there any gene activity once people have gone beyond?
Well, how far? And can you really assess gene expression in these donors? That was a big question. And so we went through a process of orchestrating a cadaveric donor process. We got over 900 donors. We acquired many tissues from all of these donors, did a lot of quality control. And
who does all that technical work, let's say? Harvesting the parts.
So we contracted with organizations that do this. And
so maybe med students might have been doing it?
No, there are organizations that acquire tissues from cadaveric donors, people who donate their bodies for research purposes. And so there's a significant brain bank in Florida, for instance, one of the organizations that we partnered with. And so the upshot of this program was that through a very significant orchestrated endeavor that you would never have been able to support through individual research projects, we got the tissue. Investigators that we funded developed statistical methods to answer these questions, and it's really beginning to pay off. So the research is still, the results are still coming out, but people are very excited because now we can correlate the genetic changes that result in differences in susceptibility to disease to the changes that result in gene expression to now begin to link those two things.
So that is a high payoff for a high risk.
Right. Yes. And I think the payoff for this particular program will really start to come to the fore. And within the next couple of years, we're very excited about that.
So overseeing the high risk, high reward program and the common fund under your Office of Strategic Coordination, do you think you're in the most exciting place of all at NIH, which is pretty widely acknowledged to be an exciting agency?
I really like my job. Yeah, the science that we participate in and have the privilege to support within our office is very exciting. And it's also nice that we have the opportunity to interact with people across the NIH to develop these programs and to oversee them. I think probably the best job at the NIH is probably the NIH director's job, but I like my job a lot.
Dr. Elizabeth Wilder is director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination. Share both parts of this interview with colleagues at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Advances in Healthcare Month, sponsored by Battelle on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search healthcare.